I am here with Becky Carmel on June 28th, 2019 at Solaris in Hudson, New York for the Oral History Summer School. Becky, would you please introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Becky Carmel. I'm excited to be here. And I'd like to invite you to introduce yourself because you skipped your name.
All right, we're going to start over.
No, we don't have to start over. I just want your name on the record so the people know.
Okay, I'm Rhonda Robinson Thomas, who's interviewing Becky this afternoon. Thank you for that reminder. So, Becky, I want to start with a question for you. Could you please tell me a little bit about some of the most significant events or experiences in your life that have shaped the woman that you have become?
Whoa. The most significant experiences in my life that have shaped the woman I've become. Well, I suppose the things coming to my mind first have to do with my independence. The things that come to mind first are, rooted in family, dealing with moving out young. That's an interesting place to start right now. But significant experiences that have shaped the woman I've become. If I zoom it out from experiences and just think about significant like themes or people or principles, I think about love and all the ways I've been loved. I think about gratitude. I think about independence. I think about interconnectedness and chosen family and finding my place in the world. Think about all the communities that I've been lucky to be part of or be alongside. It's a big question, so I gave you some big answers. Thanks for asking.
So I heard you say a couple words a few times. The first word that struck me was independence. So could you tell me a little bit more about why independence is so important for you?
Well, I suppose it's been important because it's been I was going to say it's been my survival at times, but I'm not sure quite if that's how I'd put it if I weren't being asked this exact question in this context, you know? I think, independence is a matter of survival when can't get by being dependent.
So tell me about some of the communities that have been important in your life.
Well, in my younger years, I went to a lot of different public schools, so I had a lot of friend groups rooted in different schools, and I've had many chosen families over the years, which are small communities in their own ways, and grown up in New York City, which is a very populated place full of many communities, which I say with all different understandings of what a community can look like, be it a neighborhood or race or ethnic or country of origin-based community. And then I guess thinking of just the past year and present life, communities based around jobs or interests. Sort of loose definitions of communities too, including communities that wouldn't call themselves communities. It's just people who get together in friendship or camaraderie, people who look out for each other. I feel very, very looked out for. And I look out for a lot of people. I'm a caregiver. I've been one professionally for well over a decade. Taking care of other people's children and sometimes animals and sometimes elders, and I have 100 houseplants. I like to see things grow. I like to cultivate life. I like to keep people safe in whatever ways I can, contribute to quality of life and well-being and safety and joy and all the ways that those things manifest.
So you said those communities are important to in shaping the woman that you have become. So can you talk about perhaps specifically a little bit more? Maybe you've named a lot of communities, but could you choose one of those communities and talk a little bit more about how they've impacted your life?
I don't know that it's that straightforward. Mm. I think even the idea of a community is one thing that has one impact is like a little more tidy than the reality of a constellation or a tangle of people, of friends, of. So I don't know that I have, I suppose I have answers, but nothing's jumping to mind. Mm-hmm. Questions about a community, like a specific community that's shaped me in a specific way, that was it, right?
Yes.
I don't know. I got some sort of broad strokes, but things like that all the other caregivers, the other nannies and babysitters I know have deeply informed how I've grown within doing that work. Things like that.
So can you talk a little bit more about what it's like to be a caregiver of children or elders? You've named a couple, again, different groups. But what is it like to be a caregiver? How did you come into that work, and how has it changed over the years? As you said, you've been involved in quite a while.
That's three big questions right there. Well, I can tell you that, and this loops back to our class and why we're here and why we're sitting in this dining hall right now. Last year when I took the oral history and care work class, one of the biggest project I came out of it with in my heart, like, okay, this is an outgrowth of my work, like a seed that's been planted that I just have to water, is taking these skills of taking the framework of oral history and the technical skills of now knowing how to work a recorder and sitting down with the people who've been my colleagues in doing this work, with the other nannies and the other babysitters, and making a podcast out of long-form conversations between us. Now, you asked me three big questions, and I've lost track of what they are, but I was thinking of this because I think these big questions deserve many episodes of answers. I think that there's so much there in every person and in every caregiver and in every, well, I was going to say every interaction between people doing, but not everyone is chock full of, I mean, not every conversation is about like the deep soul work, purpose, growth stuff, which is not to say that they aren't all significant, but that I wanna uplift and honor the caregiving wisdoms and the personal life stories of people who do this work.
Can you talk about how you became a caregiver?
Sure. So I mean, by the loosest definition, started babysitting my sister when we were both very young. I had my little specialties of pasta and hot dogs, and we put ketchup on both. I mean, that's probably when I was, I don't know for sure. I think around 9, give or take a year. Which progressed to looking after the baby down the hall in our apartment building. And then by the time I was 14, I was remembering this recently. No, 13. I was 13. I was thinking about this recently, just kind of thinking, what the fuck? Pardon my language. Because I remembered that I was taking care of 2 afternoons a week, these 4 kids, 2 of whom were still in diapers. And they were ranging from something like 10, 6, 2, and 1. And I was 13. I'm sure getting paid very little. But by the time I was 16, I started working 5 days a week after school doing childcare. And I graduated high school a little bit early. And yeah, just worked at least part-time, sometimes full-time. And from 16 till now, it's been, you know, working full-time.
So tell me how your jobs have changed over the years. You said you started with your sister and then with the neighbor and then working 5 days a week after school, and now full-time, right? So can you talk a little bit about that trajectory from, you know, taking care of your sister to now, you know, as a professional caregiver?
Well, I'm thinking both about how my jobs have changed, but also when you asked that, where my mind really went was like how my work has changed, which I mean in terms of work that's paid and like purpose work, work that gets done even when you're not getting paid, work that is just deeply aligned with who I am, what gives me life, what feels necessary to do. So, I mean, when it comes to the jobs, you just got a loose overview just now of how it built up from, you know, just being good at looking after my little sister. I guess I went and gave myself two questions now. I'm thinking both about jobs and about work. Thinking about how jobs have changed and how work has changed. Well, they've changed and I've changed. I've gotten wiser and more experienced. And I started out pretty wise, so. Yeah.
So tell me about those jobs. What kind of jobs do you do now? Or have you done, you know, after, like, post high school? Like full time, part time, live in?
I mean, the answer is yes. All three of those I've done, yes. Just to talk about my work families from the past year, though, I've had, well, for a year and a half, maybe more like a year and three quarters, I've had three families that I see every week, piecing together a full time schedule. Each of the families has two kids. And I heard that AC come on, and I don't even have the headphones on, so I know you really heard it. So these three families, I've been with for, like I said, about a year and three quarters. Another one for 7 years, and another one for 5.5 now. I really love the long-term relationships. And the family that I've been with for 7 years just moved yesterday. I had my last official day with them on Tuesday night. So just, you know, hours before I took the train to come up here. So I'm deep right now in the reflections of what this relationship has meant and continues to mean to me. How I imagine these children being young people. They're young people. The older one is 14 now. How I imagine them being in my life and how I wish to be in theirs. And also where I was 7 years ago and how these two kids and their two parents have, in a unique way, been the most consistent thing over those 7 years that I've had people who've been in my life that long, but not who I see twice a week every week, not with that kind of consistency. So I'm thinking a lot about time. Something that I say often is that kids are the best marker of time passing. There's nothing else that I've experienced quite like it.
So tell me a little bit more about how kids are the markers. What do you mean by that phrase? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure.
Sounds really interesting.
Thanks, Rhonda. You know how people, I feel like it's very common that even if kids aren't a day-to-day part of your life, that whenever you do come across a kid you've known for years, it's like, oh, you were here the last time I saw you. And, well, I guess you can't get that on the recorder. I'm gesturing with my hand. You know what I'm doing. Everybody knows this. It's like you blink and they're grown up. That kids, both with the visual of how you see their growth and just all the non-visible ways that they're developing and changing, they show time passing in a beautiful way, let alone that birthdays and birthdays and holidays for those who celebrate them are often much more symbolic or enriched or just charged when there are children around. Yeah, and like I said, I love seeing things grow, including people. I think growth is a beautiful way to mark time.
So let's return to those podcasts that you said you want to develop. Tell me about the importance of these stories, these voices that you think need to be not only preserved but shared, right, with the world.
Yeah, thanks. So it feels funny to talk about it. Now I'm thinking like, oh, well, am I going to put this in the oral history summer school archive? But let me not get ahead of myself and just come back to the moment. It's going to be called, or is called, I've recorded two conversations for it so far, Won't You Be My Colleague? Which is a little nod to Mr. Rogers' Won't You Be My Neighbor? The idea of the invitation and the community building, and also a little bit of legitimacy of calling each other colleagues in a field where that term doesn't get thrown around. And I have a long list of people I have in mind, because doing this for so many years, I've met a lot of people. And a good handful, more than a handful, I've spoken to about it. There are a bunch of people who are some combination of intuit, ready, interested, curious, reluctant, intrigued, but hesitant. Just a whole mixed bag of feelings. Because by and large, myself included, we don't have much experience individually or collectively with recording or content creating around this domestic work, or yeah, that's it. making a podcast. I'm very excited about it, and there have been stretches of months in the period from last June to now where this project is in my mind every day. I can't let it go. It feels so crystal clear, and it came to me kind of all in one rush this night last year when I was in Hudson. My host, who lives here in Hudson and is a wonderful caregiver, and this was matched up by Oral History Summer School. She took me out with a group of her early childhood education friends to go see the Mr. Rogers documentary that had just come out called Won't You Be My Neighbor. And we had a sweet conversation after. We'd already bonded a lot over doing this work and the ways we understood each other and the ways it was different. And we just made the joke, won't you be my colleague? I think I said it to her and she was like, that's the name of your podcast. And I forgot where I was going with that little anecdote. But it came to me in that, that's what I was saying, the one sort of rush of a clear vision. And I was writing down names of all the people I wanted to talk to and writing down sort of principles that I knew I wanted to hold dear. Like, I felt very clear about it. And I still do, and aware of the places where I still have these question marks of like, well, how do I put this out there in the world? Do I care if it's released with the same chronology that the episodes were recorded? Do I want to record an additional introduction before the conversation? These little questions of like, okay, well, what can it look like? What do I want it to look like to make an oral history podcast? I haven't come across that. Occasionally, I've come across an unedited, like a podcast that will release an edited and an unedited version. And I always listen to the unedited version because I like those little moments and the little exchanges, the things that aren't important, the things that, I mean, aren't important. I'll put that in finger quotes. That's why I'm so into oral history. It's been very exciting for me to be back for a second round.
So tell me what you hope your audience will learn from these podcasts. Listening to the voices of caregivers?
That's a good question. That's a good project design question. My main, the audience in my heart is other people doing this work. I intend for this to be open and out there and available for anyone to listen to, but the people who I imagine we're speaking to when we're recording are other people doing care work, even if it's not the exact same kind of care work. My sort of long vision for it is to do seasons grouped around different kinds of care work. So a season about taking care of other people's children, a season taking care of other people's maybe plants and animals, a season. Perhaps of elder care or end-of-life care. I know people doing very interesting work of all different kinds in the death and dying field. And for each of these, all these manifestations of care work, they can be so different from one another. You know, even taking care of plants can happen in so many different ways, in so many different contexts, with so many different understandings. But the commonalities and some of the big overarching stuff crosses fields, it crosses genres. I also, part of the vision for it is that I don't know anyone who does just one kind of care work who's never done other kinds. Another season I was thinking of was people who care for other people's homes and spaces. That I know people doing very different, but always with overlap. Like I have a colleague who is a housekeeper who's worked in the same home where I've taken care of children for many years, and she also has recently become a dog groomer. So she's got crossover and between homes and spaces and animal care. And what was my other example I was just thinking of? Oh, that one of my nanny friends also does, I learned this, you know, deep into friendship and conversation with her, but that she has done, I can't remember exactly how she would call it, but through word of mouth, goes to people's homes who have problems with hoarding and saving and acquiring things. And she helps them with their space. Or I think about the whole field of doula work in the broadest sense, from birth doula to death doula, abortion doula, life transition doula, that there's all these interesting crossovers between these kinds of work. I don't know if I forgot what the original question was.
No, you answered it, and I'm finding this very fascinating to hear more about the different types of caregivers and the crossover nature of caregiving. I'm wondering if you can talk, and I think the question is, these stories, that's your audience, right? These people who are involved in the caregiving field. But I still want you to tell me, like, why is it important for them to hear each other's stories? If the main audience are the caregivers, like, what do they gain from hearing each other's stories? Talk about, like, why that's your target group.
Well, I can't tell you what's important for people who haven't listened to it yet. You know, I can't speak on behalf of other hypothetical people, but I can tell you for me, it has been important to know other caregivers, and particularly other nannies, since that has predominantly been my work. It's been important to know them and talk to them for many reasons, to have my own work contextualized, to discuss often particularities of the job. It can be things like money, things like working conditions, things that are perhaps built into other jobs, or where the discussions about them are built in because you're working alongside other people doing this work. But childcare work like this is often in isolation, you know, all spread out and separated in different homes. And remembering what the question was again. You're saying, why is it important for them?
Like for you, to
for
hear
me,
the story.
Yeah, I was saying why it's important for me. Yeah, it's grown me as a person and as a professional. It's given me a sense of place. Oh, I see the time. Okay. What was I going to say about a sense of place? It's also been, as many of the relationships in my life are, just one more arena within which I'm blessed to engage in, like, meaningful relationships and solidarity across difference. And I know that I occupy a very unique little spot in the social, whatever you call it, of being born and raised in New York City and white, and to have done this for so many years and spoken, become friends with so many nannies with a wide variety of contexts for doing this work, of ages, of countries of origin, of language and respect in their jobs, of just such a, you know, it's diverse. There's so much history there. There's so much wisdom there. There's so much context there. There's so much lived experience there. And there's also something about, like, I'm thinking of that word transmission because we used it in class today, about transmission of knowledge. And of passing on lessons, and of paying it forward, and of like letting someone know how to make a wheel so they don't have to reinvent the wheel. I'm now at a point where I have really, and there have been many occasions for this just in the last month, but really stepped into, like, being that older nanny who's like, you know, you could ask them for more an hour. Or a situation that came up just in the schoolyard last week was, if finding out that this much younger babysitter buys the kids ice cream every day out of what she's getting paid. And I was like, those parents should be reimbursing you. Just things like that, that oftentimes, because of the nature of this work or the circumstances of our lives, sometimes you don't know for sure what you deserve until someone else is like, no, you deserve that. I'm always advocating for people to ask for more money. I think this is sacred work. It's important work. Deeply, deeply trusting and trusted.
Can you talk about the perception of caregivers? You know, you talked about like the colleague word, and it seems like, and you've talked a lot about, like, you know, sometimes people are taken advantage of because of their youth or their inexperience. So it seems like there's...
Or any other factors or reasons.
There's like this internal world, but then there's also kind of this external world where, you know, tell me about your experiences of people, you know, sort of looking at you as a caregiver, like inside, you know, the business, and then from the outside. Does that make sense? Like people like me looking in and seeing you as a caregiver versus people who are hiring you to take care of their children, their perceptions of you as a caregiver. What have your experiences with that been like?
I kind of want to zoom it back to the very first part of your question where you were like, what about perceptions of caregivers? It's so, is that all right if I just take that little bite out of the whole dish? Oh, see, now I lost my little train of thought. Let me hop back on it. All right, so what are perceptions of caregivers? I think much of the time those perceptions are informed by these dynamics going on in the world, even outside of the realm of caregiving. I think so often perception of caregivers is informed by ideas about race, ideas about culture, about language, about education. These ideas that are often just propped up by like the systems of power that we're living under. I know that there's a multiplicity of ways in all different interactions that I've been perceived or not as, or perceived as a non-parental caregiver or perceived as a parental caregiver. That for the most part, all the children I've taken care of have been white and blonde or with light brown hair and could pass for my biological children very easily. There's one baby in particular who looks more like me than he does like his parents. So there are ways, I guess I assumed when you said perceptions of caregivers that we were talking about people who aren't parents or aren't family. So that I have had that experience and that I haven't. There are all kinds of remarks or interactions that tip me off to how someone else is experiencing me or what assumptions they're coming in with. But a great lesson to have internalized or be in the process of, and one that I like to sort of pass forward in all the occasions where this shows up, is that, how do I phrase it well? That those remarks that another person makes about me is information about them, not information about me. I like to pass that one along because I think the ability to be like, return to sender, is a great asset in a culture, society, moment, interaction where people are always trying to send you some shit to be like, oh, nope, you addressed this to me, but I'm not accepting this package. Is a very valuable skill.
So it sounds like that's the outsider perceptions. Have you found that as a caregiver you have to deal with those who employ you? Are there certain perceptions that are manifested toward you? Positive, negative, neutral?
I don't quite know what to make of that question. I would say that I suppose the short answer is that I work for people who treat me right. That a big part of prioritizing these long-term relationships is the children, how I care for them, and how meaningful I think it is to have people who stay in your life for a good long while. But that what has allowed me to do that is working for parents who, by and large, treat me with respect in our everyday interactions, treat me with respect in compensation, in allowing raises when it is time, and in paying me when they go away on vacation, in paid sick days, however we negotiate the specifics of these agreements. It's all tying back. I mean, these are all themes and things that I look forward to discussing in front of a recorder at another time for the purposes of this podcast. I notice it's getting darker in this room and I am wondering about time. Would you like to?
So tell me anything else that we haven't covered. Like if you had one final thing to say about your life or about your work as a caregiver or about this dream that you are putting into action regarding this podcast series, like what's that final thought to kind of end this first installment of a conversation that I'm sure will be continuing between us.
Yes, thank you, Rhonda. I'm looking forward to that too. Well, you said everything we haven't talked about, that could take a long time. That I am grateful to have had the opportunity to just free associate and reflect with you tonight, that I am grateful to have made the life for myself, that I just remembered how we're both wrapping it up on a note of gratitude in our narratives, but grateful to have made this life for myself, to do the work that I do, to have the savings that I have, to have the skills that I have, to have the colleagues that I have, the quality of life that I have, and to be in, I was going to call it a season of my life, but I mean that in a broad way, like a few years, year and a half, I don't know, long season of really getting to learn new things and do new things, to have the time and the ability and the freedom and the quality of life and the wellness of being to be like, you know what, let me apply to this oral history summer school thing and see what that's about. Let me dream up a podcast. Let me join a chorus. Let me start painting again. These things that are just enriching and expanding, that remind me of all the ways that I can grow and that I am growing and that I have grown. That's good shit. That's my closing note. Thank you, Rhonda.
And thank you, Becky. It's, wow, it's been a pleasure. I had no idea that you have been holding in over the last 48 hours after you introduced yourself on that first day and just gave us that little tiny window into this dream that you're holding in your heart. So it's been very humbling and such a pleasure to hear you talk about your work and that journey that you took to get where you are today, and to see you in such a happy, peaceful, joyful place.
Thank you, Rhonda.
I always enjoy hearing about people making that journey into that dream come true space where you're still growing, you haven't arrived, but you're just in that moment of flourishing. So it's been beautiful to hear you articulate that this afternoon.
Well, thank you. Thank you.